I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. There's an absorbing new book out, Willful Blindness, Why We Ignore the Obvious at Our Peril. It's a fascinating book that chronicles anecdotes where turning a blind eye to things has led to big problems. Invariably, in the review of things, we realize what went wrong and ask, how were we so blind? The book's author, Margaret Heffernan, joins me now. Could disasters like the BP oil well rupture have been anticipated? How could no one know prisoners were being tortured in Abu Ghraib? How was the housing bubble missed? How do we let credit card bills go unopened? In the book, she also looks at the studies of psychologists and neuroscientists and offers explanations as to why we turn the other cheek, as it were. It's a fascinating book. Margaret Heffernan is a former producer for BBC Radio and TV, and she's had vast experience as an entrepreneur, having been CEO of several companies. Her previous books include The Naked Truth, How She Does It, and Women on Top. Her work has been compared to the books of Malcolm Gladwell. She blogs for the Huffington Post and writes for other publications. Her website is at mheffernan.com. The book is published by Doubleday in Toronto this day. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Margaret Heffernan. Good morning, Ms. Heffernan.
Hi, good morning. It's really nice to be here in Canada.
Thanks for joining us. Where's home for you?
Oh, golly, that's a hard question.
Yeah.
Well, I live mostly in England, but I also have a house in the States.
Yeah. Now, you start the book with a sort of legal definition of willful blindness. I guess the first time it ever appeared was in a case in England, right? Some century and a half ago or so?
That's right. I mean, it started about 150 years ago in England. But basically, the law for the legal concept of willful blindness says if there are things that you could have known and should have known but somehow managed not to know, the law still treats you as if you had known that information. And it's most often used in drug trafficking cases, where if I give you a suitcase and tell you to take it to New York and you don't open it and it turns out to be full of cocaine, it doesn't matter that you didn't know, you're still responsible. And I encountered this when I was doing some work on the Enron trials, and I suddenly thought, wow, you know, this is a very powerful idea. There are an awful lot of areas in life where there are things that we could and should know, but we really struggle quite hard not to know. And I wonder why that is and how it happens. And that's really what led me down the road of the book, kind of exploring what are all the forces at work that stop us knowing things that we really might be safer if we did take the time to think about them.
Now, is it a struggle that goes on in our head?
Oh, it's a struggle all the time, and it's partly a physiological, biological thing, which is that you cannot take in everything, and so your mind is constantly editing the information it lets in and the information that it doesn't let in. And to some degree, that's, you know, that's about efficiency, because there's an awful lot of stuff, you know, you just don't need to know. But the thing that I was really fascinated by is how are we making these decisions, and how does it happen that we quite often make them so badly? So I was interested both in our private lives, you know, whether it's a spouse having an affair or it's child abuse within families or it's not going to the doctor and getting a checkup, not opening credit card bills, or looking at organizations and companies where things are warned about for years and only late in the day do things, you know, really blow up. So I wanted to know, why is it in all these walks of life we ignore the things that we sometimes most need to pay attention to?
So you mentioned the Enron case, so let's talk about that, because the term willful blindness
right.
was something that we read about quite a bit when we, I guess it was Mr. Skilling, was it?
That's right. Well, I wrote two plays about Enron, and one of the things that struck me when I was doing the research for those is that it was very obvious to hundreds of people working at Enron that this was a deeply corrupt, illegal company. In fact, virtually everybody working there knew that. And so I thought to myself, God, how could it be that Ken Lay could stand up and say, I really had no idea? Now, there are two potential explanations. Either he was just lying, or there were reasons that he couldn't see what was happening. And from everything I knew about Lay, I believed, and people, there are some people who disagree with me, but I believed he wasn't lying. But I thought, you know, part of what's happening is Ken Lay believes he's a good man. A good man doesn't run a corrupt company. Therefore, the company couldn't be corrupt. So he simply could not see, would not acknowledge what was right in front of his face. And also, the thing that Lay suffered from is what I call in my book the bubble of power, which is you live in a world where you go from your limo to your executive offices to your private jet. You're surrounded by people who will tell you what you want to hear. And at no point does reality truly impinge. And I think that is true of many chief executives of large corporations and many political leaders, you know, that they're in a little self-serving, self-affirming bubble. And challenging, difficult information simply does not penetrate.
And so being in this bubble of power, so I'm thinking of the president. It doesn't matter which president, any president.
Correct.
Yeah. They have to be in a bubble, it seems, because getting all sorts of information from different people, well, first of all, it's time-consuming, and it could be misleading in some way, so they have to be, the channels to get to the president are quite few.
Right.
So whose fault is that? Is that the system? Is that the president for allowing themselves to be put in a bubble? Is
well,
it the people around
say,
him?
Yeah, I have to say, in the case of leaders, you know, of organizations or countries, I think part of their job is to find structural ways to ensure that bubble is regularly punctured, because it is the biggest single risk to their ability to do the job. And there are many chief executives of organizations who have told me, you know, the most important thing for me to do is to have people, trusted advisors, who are able and willing to stand up and tell me when I'm wrong, stand up and tell me information that I don't want to hear. Nobody ever gives leaders that network of people. You have to go out and find it and build it and make sure that you aren't cut off from the real world. And if you don't do that, you will be.
But isn't it too a symptom of the system, or whatever system that is? I mean, we just don't have the time to hear everybody, read everything.
Yeah, you don't have the question to hear everybody and read everything. But I think you have to recognize that unless you surround yourself with people who will challenge you, you'll get cut off. And, you know, this was very clear, for example, in the Bush White House, where no challenging, disconfirming counter-arguments were ever even raised. It's not a question that it was all articulated and rejected. It wasn't articulated at all. And Bush was clearly surrounded by people who knew that their careers and good, you know, and advancement depended on delivering information that would make the president feel good about himself.
In the book, you spend a lot of time talking about the science behind all this, and I find that fascinating.
Yeah, indeed.
Because it's interesting to see how our brains, our minds work.
And it's not the way we think at all, is it?
Yeah. So what is the research that you encountered? What does that say?
Well, I think there are lots of interesting things. I think one of them is the fact that our brain has very limited, finite cognitive capacity. We cannot possibly take in everything. Now, that has all sorts of consequences. If you try to do too much, you actually don't have much control over what gets left out. It's why you really cannot drive your car and talk on the cell phone at the same time. You're going to miss stuff. It may be really important stuff, but essentially when you're on the cell phone and you're driving, your cognitive capacity is the same as if you were over the alcohol limit. Exactly the same is true if you've worked through the night and lost a night's sleep. And one of the arguments in my book is, you know, we need to take more seriously the way that we expect our brain somehow to absorb and manage, you know, everything all the time. It won't do it, and it really will let us down. The other thing which I think, you know, is a revelation to me, talking to neuroscientists about this, is that our brain has an absolute preference for what's familiar and known. So it's a little bit like if you went to your office today and it was the rush hour and there was a security guard. You know, it's all that information rushing to get through at once. What is the security guard going to let through first? He's going to let through the people he knows. He's going to wait, make the strangers wait. So anything that sort of locks on to information we already have gets through faster. That means we tend to like people who look a lot like us. We tend to like people who have initials similar to us. We tend to marry people who look a lot like us, are about the same height, about the same hair color, eye color, age, etc. What that means when we come to hire people is that we have an inbuilt biological bias to hire people who are very much like us. And it's not about political correctness or any of that jazz. It's that we have a sort of physical preference for people that are familiar, and the thing we're most familiar with is ourselves. So what that means in terms of employing people is that you have to recognize your bias when you set about interviewing people and find different ways of redressing it. Very fascinating tests on bias show that everybody is biased. You know, men prefer men, women prefer women, white doctors prefer white patients. You know, the elderly are generally discriminated against by young doctors. These are biological patterns in our makeup, and if we don't recognize their existence, then they will determine how we make our decisions.
So here's a tough question. How do we get away from that? How do we get away from our biases in the sort?
Well, the first thing you have to do is acknowledge that they're there.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting, you know, when I talk to groups of people and ask them how many of them are biased, you know, lots of people think they aren't.
Yeah.
Lots of people think, well, my friends are biased, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first thing is we need to come clean and recognize this is just a sort of physical fact. Now how do we mitigate it? Very important, I think, whether you're talking about your private life or your work life, to seek out and truly cherish people who are different from you, who will argue with you, who will bring you information which is not necessarily everything that you want to hear. Also, very important to identify the kind of the ruts we get into, the sort of thinking patterns we get into, and think about how to change those from time to time. Very interesting study that showed medical students improved their diagnostic skills when they started studying art history. In other words, they just started using their minds in different ways. And if we recognize that we all are drawn into these kind of routines, it's very healthy for everybody to break those routines from time to time. Interestingly, you know, this whole thing on cognitive overload and how much we can take in, one of the very few things that really will increase your cognitive capacity isn't yoga or meditation or any of that stuff. It's simply getting exercise.
Mm.
Because the more you exercise, the more oxygen you get to your brain and the more efficient it will be.
One of the other fascinating things that you talk about in the book is how you relate it to our personal lives.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of being involved with someone who's not good for us.
Right.
People around us tell us that they're not mm-hmm. good for us, but we don't see that, and we only see
right.
the good, say.
Right.
What happens there in the head, I guess?
Well, I think, you know, very often what happens is we become very dependent on our relationships, and, of course, romantic relationships do deliver all sorts of neurochemicals to the brain that make us feel very wonderful, and may even become somewhat addictive.
Mm.
What that means is that when we start seeing signs that the relationship isn't all it should be, if we're married to an alcoholic, for example, or if the person we're married to shows signs of perhaps, you know, wandering, we will try very hard not to put those clues together. And it's why very often, you know, our friends and family may have figured these things out before we do. I think the hopeful thing, which I found in the course of writing the book, is that we try not to see these things because we're so afraid of the consequences. And yet, in almost all cases, once we confront the consequences, we really liberate our capacity to respond. You know, so many people I've interviewed who, once they finally did face facts, found that they were much stronger and much more capable of dealing with them than they ever imagined. So I think we often underestimate our own capacity to respond. And when we finally do have to confront reality, more often than not discover that we really are up for it.
Let me bring in a sort of work experience that most people will have. And let's say you're working in an office. You've got, there's two of you sharing a space. And you can see that the other person cuts corners in a way that could quite possibly bring serious consequence later on. But we don't bring it up. We don't tell the other person, hey, stop doing that. Because we work in a space close enough that we just really want to get along with them. That happens a lot, doesn't it?
It does happen a lot, and not just in offices. The place where it's perhaps most studied, this can be pretty alarming, the place it's most studied is in hospitals, where you know an incompetent doctor or an abusive nurse is very well known to everybody. Everybody in that hospital knows, you know, that she's a bad nurse or he's a bad doctor. And it's most common that nobody will do anything about it. And one of the things that I go into in quite a lot of detail in my book is, you know, well, how do you surface these things? Because it makes everybody very unhappy. Everybody's aware of it, but they're not quite sure how to handle it. And I would say also, you know, the business school students that I teach, this is a burning issue for them because they've all been in situations where their values really were tested. And I think what has emerged from all that work is that there are always more ways of having the conversation than you imagine. There are always more allies out there for you than you think there are. So it's quite important often not to raise these issues alone. And it's only when you raise them that there's any chance of dealing with them. And I think what's really interesting in many of the hospital examples that I use is that people somehow felt if they talked among themselves, they were somehow dealing with the problem. But of course, they're not dealing with the problem. They're just trying to get rid of their sense of responsibility for it. In the end, there are always more ways of solving the problem than most people imagine on their own. But it's very important to build allies before you try to do anything about it.
You mentioned earlier the fear that we have over consequences.
Yeah.
Is it your view that we are afraid of say what we need to do, or are we just lazy? Like, are we afraid to work?
I think we're afraid of conflict. I think you know that we think if I raise the issue, there'll be a fight. If there's a fight, I won't know how to manage it. And I'd say a couple of things. One is very often, you don't even have to raise the issue, you just have to ask some good questions. The second thing I'd say is that very often there isn't a fight. There's a huge sense of relief that somebody has finally articulated what everybody is secretly worrying about. I mean, this happens at work all the time. You know, thank goodness someone finally brought it up. And the other thing I'd say is conflict is usually much worse in our heads than in reality. But I do think, and again, I do a lot of work on this at the business schools where I teach, I do think we all need to learn how to do conflict better. Because running away from conflict almost always makes problems worse. Whereas surfacing the problem and dealing with it is the only surefire way of having a chance to solve these problems. And, you know, you can look at the banks and the property bubble recently, and it's, of course, nonsense to say nobody knew that there was a problem. Everybody knew that there was a problem. Had it been addressed earlier, there would be probably fewer foreclosures and fewer bankruptcies. So our running away from the problem really does no favors to anybody.
But does corporate America, does big business, does that have to change too? I mean, let's just say you're not a manager, you're not the president, not the CEO, and you're overworked. You're you know somewhere in the middle there or lower, and you can't cope with making sure you cross the T's and dot the I's.
Well, I think there's several things in that situation. I think the first thing is, you know, to ask yourself, well, is that because of the way that, you know, you're managing yourself, or is really too much being expected of you? If too much is being expected of you, is there a way to have that conversation with your manager? Is it that nobody knows that you're overworked? Because half the time everybody thinks that everybody knows, when in fact nobody does. If, you know, is it part of the culture that everybody has worked like that? In which case, are you sure that you want to stay, and what are your options? I think one of the things I would say, because I deal with students grappling with these issues a very great deal, is, first of all, you know, find all the different options that you think there are, but also make sure in the way that you manage your private life that if this is really becomes unbearable and you are quite convinced after many attempts that nobody's going to fix it, make sure you can afford to walk away. One of the things that most worries me about, you know, the property bubble and increasing amounts of debt is that the more indebted you are, the more you may feel that you can't afford to leave a truly toxic work environment. And I'm a very big fan of making sure that you always have your running away money. Because sometimes, you know, I'm fairly optimistic, and I think most managers, when they understand a problem, will try to fix it. But if they can't, or they won't, you need to be able to look after yourself.
Margaret, this is the most fascinating book. We could talk all day about what's in here. Congratulations on it. Good luck with it.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great talking to you about it.
The website is mheffernan.com. The book is called Willful Blindness, Why We Ignore the Obvious at Our Peril. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Margaret Heffernan, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.